from the diving submersible Beulah, cruising at the deep end of the Rotary Club swimming pool in Research Triangle Park. This is your North Carolina Reading Service, formerly the Triangle Radio Reading Service, with Indie Week of March the 3rd, 2020. Reading for our audience of blind and print-impaired listeners, I am John Fetterson. And before opening this week's issue, we offer thanks to our deep-sea duo, Marlene and Thor, for our intro music today. Thanks, folks. And out they go past the airlock. And for our opener, ordinarily we don't read this Jeff Billman's intro column, but this one is Department of Corrections. And he says, nothing I hate more than sloppy mistakes, especially when I make them in stories I'm writing or miss them in stories I'm editing. I hate that sloppiness undermines important reporting. And I hate that human fallibility is so often perceived as malice. We made several mistakes over the last week. Last Monday night, in a story about a Durham County Board of Commissioners meeting, Tomasi McDonald errantly reported that the Durham Association of Educators had withdrawn its endorsement of Commissioner Brenda Howerton over her comments about Commissioner Heidi Carter. In addition, he also muffed a quote from Carter. The story posted late at night. By early Tuesday morning, my phone was blowing up with people demanding a correction. I quickly corrected the story. Tomasi has since posted a longer apology and explanation along with some thoughts about divisive racial politics in Durham. It's worth a read. In last week's review of St. James Seafood, we got the date of the downtown Durham gas explosion wrong. It happened in 2019, not 2018. I haven't stopped kicking myself for that. In last week's profile of the Democratic Senate primary, we wrongly characterized the nature of Erica Smith's state Senate district. She did not defeat an incumbent Republican, but rather a Democrat in the primary. In the general election in 2014, she ran unopposed. We also misstated where Cal Cunningham was stationed in the Middle East. It was in Baghdad, not Kuwait. Not all these errors are of equal importance, but I think they all trace back to the same root. I ask our writers to do a lot. Write daily blogs, weekly print stories, and long-form features. Meanwhile, we don't have a staff copy editor or a fact-checker. Our editors, myself included, do their best, but we, especially me, are an imperfect and hurried lot. I don't say that as an excuse. There isn't one. And the responsibility for whatever errors appears in this paper or on our website ultimately lies with me. I say it, rather, as an explanation. Like much of the industry, our writers are too often stressed, underpaid and underappreciated. They work tirelessly to produce journalism that makes a difference because they believe in what we do. And we'll continue busting our butts to do that, just hopefully without screwing up at least as much. Our Voices column from Jonathan Weiler, teaching professor in global studies, UNC Chapel Hill. Since the beginning of the 21st century, was titled The Plot to Control America, Part 1. Since the beginning of the 21st century, the GOP has tried by various means across the country to winnow the electorate in order to make it harder for certain groups of voters to cast ballots. The original sin of this two-decade-long effort transpired in 2000 when a firm hired by then-Florida Governor Jeb Bush wrongly purged perhaps thousands of eligible voters from the state's voter rolls on the mistaken grounds that they had been convicted of felonies and were, therefore, ineligible to vote. In a plot twist that we would normally ascribe to a tin-pot dictatorship, that purge of mostly black voters swamped the scant 537-vote margin by which the governor's brother won Florida that year and thereby secured the presidency. In 2006, we learned the Bush administration had engaged in its own purge. In a highly unusual move, it fired several United States attorneys, ostensibly because they'd taken part in various forms of malfeasance or insubordination. But as subsequent investigations revealed, they were actually sacked for refusing to pursue bogus voter fraud cases. The Bush administration had begun insisting that voter fraud, especially in-person fraud, in which people who were not eligible to vote showed up to cast ballots anyway, was a serious problem requiring a crackdown. In fact, every credible study of such fraud, the putative target of the election security laws that have passed in recent years, has found the same thing. It's virtually non-existent in the United States. An early omen of what was to come occurred in Ohio in 2004. Republican Secretary of State Ken Blackwell issued a series of rules and directives that made it harder for voters to register and cast provisional ballots. One rule, for example, allowed only voter registration applications that were submitted on 80-pound stock paper. It was scrapped because of the outcry. Others, sharply limiting the circumstances in which provisional ballots could be submitted and considered, were altered or modified, but the intent was clear: to sow confusion and discourage voting. The targets of these shenanigans, unsurprisingly, were disproportionately African Americans. In 2006, Indiana became the first state in the country to require voters to present a valid form of photo ID. When Americans are asked whether they support such measures, a clear majority say they do. It seems like a common sense idea, and most Americans have photo IDs, so what's the harm? It turns out that, while most Americans do, between 3 and 10% of voters do not, and most of them are African American and Hispanic. In a complicated split decision in 2008, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld Indiana's law in part on the grounds it was not overly burdensome to voters. And the most careful studies of the impact of photo-based voter IDs have found they do not significantly deter turnout. However, as noted, the stated rationale for these laws is fiction. And whatever their impact, no one can reject the possibility that they affect the outcomes of close elections. In any event, the nuisance they introduce into the voting process, one borne disproportionately by people of color, is quite simply indefensible. The Indiana law set an important precedent. After it was upheld by the Supreme Court in 2008, and especially after the Roberts Court gutted a key provision of the Voting Rights Act of 2013, a spate of new laws, almost all passed by Republican-controlled legislators, sought to require photo IDs and otherwise make it more difficult for targeted groups of voters to cast ballots. Reflecting on this history, the eminent jurist Judge Richard Posner, originally appointed to the federal bench by President Reagan, the author of the appellate opinion upholding the Indiana law, has since reversed himself. In 2013, he acknowledged that the photo ID requirement is, quote, now widely regarded as a means of voter suppression rather than fraud prevention, because the real intent of the Indiana law and its progeny is impossible to deny. Next week, I'll take a look at the 2013 ruling and the expanding voting rights battleground that has emerged in its wake. As usual now, we'll continue with the good, the bad, and the awful. Good. The election is finally over. This one's more for us than you, though your heart might be warmed by the sudden disappearance of the ubiquitous Michael Bloomberg ads on your TV and your Facebook feed, haunting your dreams at night. We won't be out of the political spotlight for long, but we will get a much-needed breather. We frantically worked on municipal elections through October, Raleigh, and November, Durham. We didn't know who was running in the primaries until the middle of December, by which point we'd checked out for the holidays. When we got back, we threw together a million questionnaires and researched a billion candidates. Then we made endorsements. Then we caught poop for our endorsements. It has been, in a word, exhausting. Bad. Pete Buttigieg stands. We are pro-early voting. 800,000 North Carolinians voted earlier this year, about 250,000 of them last Friday and Saturday alone. It's possible that more than half of Democratic primary voters cast their ballots before Election Day, but early voting comes with pitfalls. To wit, a public policy polling survey last week had Pete Buttigieg at 9% in North Carolina. On Saturday night, after early votes had been cast, Mayor Pete came to Raleigh and packed the Broughton High School gymnasium. And then on the next day, he dropped out. Just like that. All of those Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar early votes are for naught. This is, of course, a better argument for ranked choice voting than for ending early voting, but it's unfortunate for Pete stands either way. And awful, the U.S. immigration system. It takes a special kind of cruelty to work for the deportation of Rosa Ortez Cruz, a Honduran immigrant who's been in sanctuary in a Chapel Hill church since 2017. Ortez Cruz fled Honduras 18 years ago after her partner stabbed her and threatened to kill her. But the Board of Immigration Appeals, an arm of the Department of Homeland Security, rejected her petition to stay in the country because she couldn't prove that her ex-partner still wanted to murder her. Last week, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals rejected that argument, saying the BIA couldn't simply assume her ex had been rehabilitated and arbitrarily discount expert testimony about serial abusers. That means she can stay unless the DHS figures out some other way to deport her. Around the triangle now, Lee Taus from Raleigh writes, stone unturned. A year after RDU leased land for a quarry, activists are still fighting tooth and nail to stop it. Gene Spooner doesn't quit. On March 21st, 2019, Spooner watched as members of the Raleigh-Durham Airport Authority filed into their boardroom for a meeting that lasted exactly 4 minutes and 17 seconds. An attorney read aloud a brief statement, and John Kane, a local developer who chaired the board, called for a vote. It was unanimous. The deal was done. 105 acres of densely wooded forest outside Olmsted State Park would be leased to Wake Stone. The trees would be cut, a 400-foot pit would be dug, and 30 years later, Wake Stone would return what was left of the land, all for $24 million in royalties from the sale of the stone it would mine from the ground. Spooner couldn't believe it. Some days she still can't. We thought the right thing to do was for the RDUAA to see the light and do what was better for the community, Spooner says. They did not, and here we are today. They still could. The Airport Authority and Wake Stone can still do the right thing. Spooner's organization, the Olmsted Coalition, filed a lawsuit, along with the Triangle Off-Road Cyclists, to stop the quarry deal. They argued that the four local governments that control the airport authority, Raleigh, Wake County, Durham, and Durham County, should have a say in the deal. They tried to make the issue a focal point of Raleigh city elections, only to see many of the most anti-quarry candidates defeated in October. A few weeks later, Wake County Superior Court Judge Graham Shirley ruled that RDU's lease with Wake Stone was valid and the quarry should move forward. Gene Spooner didn't quit. The Olmsted Coalition, Triangle Off-Road Cyclists, appealed, and last week, Shirley issued an injunction preventing Wake Stone from selling the stone it mines until the summer of 2022, or until the legal questions are definitely settled. That injunction doesn't mean much. Wake Stone won't be ready to sell what it mines until then anyway. The company is currently applying for mining permits, which it hopes to secure by this fall. After that, it will have to clear trees and start digging. But Spooner, nonetheless, took it as a sign of hope. She thinks the mining permit will be denied. Then again, she thought the Superior Court would strike down Wake Stone's lease, and that didn't happen. It's a bad precedent for our public lands, Spooner says. The idea of having a private quarry next to Olmsted State Park, a 400-foot pit, is super bad for our public lands. For Olmsted, also really bad for the airport. During contentious moments last fall, most local politicians, even those who weren't outspoken about the quarry, usually said they opposed the lease, even if they didn't think it was local government's place to intervene in the airport authority's decision. Not Sig Hutchinson. The Wake County Commissioner, who was up for re-election Tuesday, though the results weren't known when the Indy went to press, and self-described environmentalist, has championed the Wake Stone deal, though not because he loves quarries. As part of its agreement with RDU, Wake Stone agreed to pay $3.6 million to help the county lease 151 acres of nearby RDU-owned land for mountain biking. Known as the 286 Tract, this parcel, Hutchinson says, is better suited to the average mountain biker than the more hardcore quarry land, though bikers have illegally been using both for years. Wake Stone had been waiting till the lawsuit was wrapped up to chip in the money, and the county had been waiting on the money to secure the lease. But last month, when Hutchinson learned the airport authority was considering spending $2 million to construct a fence around the property, the unauthorized bikers pose liability concerns, he unveiled a proposal before the Board of Commissioners Growth and Sustainability Committee to lease the land for 40 years. But even if Wake Stone prevails in court, that $3.6 million will likely only cover a small portion of the county's lease. Hutchinson says he doesn't know how much that will be. The county hasn't started negotiating with RDU yet, nor is he sure where the money's going to come from. In his view, however, the county needs to act now. It can sort out the details later. I'm very hopeful, Hutchinson says, and the more I talk about it, the more energy there is around finding a solution that works for everybody. And IndyWeek has updated that story on its web to mention that Sig Hutchinson did win his primary election and will continue to the general election coming up. James Michael Nichols' column now from Durham, Cruel and Unusual. Kaunautica's Zaire Brown says DPS won't let her get the gender-affirming surgery she needs. Every day when Kaunautica's Zaire Brown walks the halls of Anson Correctional Institution in Polkton, North Carolina, she's misgendered by her fellow inmates and correctional officers and called by her dead name. Zaire Brown, a transgender woman of color, who received national media attention in 2019 following protests over her incarceration in a men's facility, has been housed at Anson since her transfer on August 15, which only came after 6 months of public pressure from advocacy groups and community leaders. In the U.S., the majority of transgender prisoners are housed in facilities that do not conform to their gender identities. Thus, Zaire Brown's transfer was a major victory. But she now faces a new obstacle. The North Carolina Department of Public Safety has denied her the final gender-affirming surgery that would complete a medical transition she was undergoing prior to her incarceration. "I feel like my mental health is depleting," Zaire Brown told the Indy recently. "I'm around females now, and it constantly reminded of my situation. It triggers my dysphoria even more." Zaire Brown has asked the DPS to either provide her with vaginoplasty, the final surgery she views as necessary for her gender transition, or create a path where she can use her own resources to finance the procedure. According to Zaire Brown, both requests have been repeatedly denied, even though they've been medically prescribed. Zaire Brown says that as a result of the denial, she's been forced to purchase special undergarments that cost $100 a pair, at least six of them so far. $600 is enough to meet to get a doctor's appointment at UNC, Zaire Brown says. The state ACLU believes Zaire Brown is entitled to gender-affirming surgery under the Eighth Amendment, which prohibits cruel and unusual punishment. Kaunautica is just one example, says Emily Seawall, the state ACLU's acting senior staff attorney. We know there are other trans folks in the prison system in North Carolina and across the country. They are constantly misgendered, they are constantly dead-named, and that is harmful to them. It causes them not just emotional harm. The suicide rates among trans folks are particularly high, and we know that trans women of color are targeted at much higher rates than anyone else in our population. So it's an issue of safety for her. It's an issue of personal agency and dignity, and it's also an issue under the Eighth Amendment that she's not being treated with cruel and unusual punishment. While the ACLU is representing Zaire Brown, it would not comment on potential litigation. However, similar arguments have met with success elsewhere. 2019, a three-judge panel on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that denying gender-affirming surgery to the transgender inmates is prohibited under the U.S. Constitution. In 2014, the Fourth Circuit didn't go quite so far. While it ruled the court wasn't required to provide the surgery to the inmate asking for it, it did say that denying it across the board violated the Eighth Amendment. DPS spokesman John Bull told the Indy in a statement that state law prohibited the department from discussing Zaire Brown's case. "What we can tell you is that requests for transgender accommodations, which would include medical procedures by policy, are reviewed by a multidisciplinary committee. Each individual situation is reviewed and decisions are made on a case-by-case basis." Zaire Brown says the media fervor that surrounded her case last year has died down since her transfer. I guess, you know, needing medical care isn't as fierce as me being transferred from a man's to a female facility, she says, and I kind of understand that, but all this stuff is wrong. I understand I'm in prison and I have to do my time, but that they're making it even harder for me. A long article by Brian Howe called Dance Like Everybody's Watching. Sarah Damski, who DJs and makes electronic music as Kier, deleted her Facebook page several years ago. She prefers to hear about events by word of mouth. I sniff out people at coffee shops, she says, laughing. Anyone who smells like patchouli, I'm like, what are you doing tonight? This sensibility is reflected in Fauna, an underground dance party that last popped up at the Fruit on February the 8th. It updates an old-school rave experience. To get in, you have to know the hosts, who will text you the location a couple of hours before it starts, with New School Durham's District Art and Magic Vibe. Distinct Art and Magic Vibe. Today, Damski is gathered with her three Fauna co-founders at Manufacture, a creative agency on Ramsar Street. It's a very Durham space, with high windows pouring creamy natural light onto exposed rafters, tall brick walls, and raw concrete floors. A new decal is affixed next to Manufacture's on the glass door. It's the logo of Maison Fauna, the Fauna Party Founders' new record label, which they are launching in tandem with Deciduous, a new weekly party that will bring national house and techno DJs to the Fruit's basement every Friday, starting on March 13th. Though all four principals stress their hive-minded collaboration, it's expedient to meet them in pairs. First, there's Damski and Simon Briggs, art school kids and hardware heads, who moved to Durham together after studying electronic music at the Art Institute in Chicago, and who DJ together as Kier and Swung. They're a contrasting couple. She, short, short-haired with expressive gestures, is Maison Fauna's de facto mouthpiece, timepiece, art director, and UK garage zealot. He, tall, long-haired, all but silent with a penetrating gaze, is the technical light and sound whiz who holds it down for ambient music. Then there's Nick DeNitto and Joe Bell, who bring the deep music industry background. Though not a couple, they, too, make a contrasting pair, with Bell's manner as muted as DeNitto's is extroverted. Born a day apart, DeNitto favors European techno, while Bell is a former rock musician who doesn't shy away from booking big tent trance music. But they share a certain club kid polish, which you can glimpse in DeNitto's fitted black t-shirt and thin gold chain, or the elegant way Bell crosses his legs and drapes his hands when he sits. It almost takes a flow chart to map the relationships of all the enterprises brewing in these bright, unfinished rooms. Manufacture is DeNitto's thing, an agency he co-founded in Los Angeles, where it's still headquartered. Ephemeral is Bell's, a year-old effort to bring music nerd-famous DJs to the Fruit. He books them through his event production company, Morning Choir. But Fauna, Maison Fauna, and Deciduous are the group's thing. Okay, fine. Deciduous is technically a co-production of Morning Choir and Maison Fauna, but this is about to break our flowchart, and you get the gist. Lots of brave little brands with fluid borders. What matters is that Maison is French for house, which refers to both the music of choice and the ambition to build an arc for Durham's gentle dance animals. Deciduous is a Latinization of deciduous, filling in the flora around the fauna to emphasize warmth, beauty, and invitingness in the organizational persona. To strengthen both their internal commitment and their pitch to partygoers, DeNitto and Bell went in on a world-class sound system, on par with, indeed, designed to be the same guy as, those at clubs like DC10 in Ibiza and Fabrique in Madrid. I play UK Garage, which has super highs and super low lows, and the mids are like, blink, a stab every 10 seconds, Damski says. It often gets completely lost. You want every range to be well represented, and this system has that. You can have a conversation right in front of it. You might think the group's parties similarly. Fauna has the base covered, super underground, while local DJs and producers, while Ephemeral covers the treble with international names like Darud and Paul Van Dyke. Next up is Dom Dola on March the 27th. Soon, Deciduous will fill out the mids that get lost in the mix, bringing in DJs who have rising clout but still play smaller rooms and who usually have little economic incentive to play here, to mix it up with locals every Friday night. It's an all-in attempt to give Durham's talent-filled yet embryonic club music scene the only thing it lacks, consistency. You got to meet this guy, Nick, Joe Bell remembers, the manager of American Underground, telling him a few years ago he worked with Skrillex. After moving here from Salt Lake City, Bell was using his sociology degree to recruit research participants for UNC and doing social media for local venues. But he played in a touring rock band in high school and wanted to get back into music, so he struck out on his own. After traveling around the country, meeting people in the concert industry, which led to working on electronic music festivals with Insomniac Events, he co-founded a marketing agency, Cult Entertainment, at American Underground. Dinito has a similarly career-shifty story. He's originally from Charleston, where he started throwing parties. We were trying to do it like we saw it done in bigger cities, he says. We were successful in that we brought electronic music to Charleston, for better or worse. Some people were happy, but some were not, because it was traditionally an indie rock area like this. Dinito moved to L.A. at the urging of high school friend Aziz Ansari. In 2010, he co-founded Manufacture, which does brands and websites for celebrities, consumer goods, and hospitality services. 5 years ago, he found himself burned out on L.A. and thought about moving into wine. His partner convinced him to stay with the agency but switch cities. Moogfest had just moved here, which was a big selling point, and your average wine bar in L.A. is not as good as Bar Brunello, Dinito says. Like Dinito, Damski and Briggs were burned out in a big city and felt the tug of Moogfest. After they graduated from art school in Chicago, they thought about moving to Baltimore, but decided on Durham after a visit. Their entree into the local scene came courtesy of Nick Wallhauser of Roundhouse, the Durham-based collective whose instrumental hip-hop core has been expanding into house and techno. Briggs went to a Roundhouse event where Wallhauser mentioned him that Quarter Horse had turntables. So Briggs went by the Durham bar and made an arcade one evening. The turntables were set up, but no one was playing, and the bartender told him to go get some records. Simon texted me while I was working at the Gocciolina. I'm DJing at Quarter Horse right now, LOL, Damski says. I was like, what? We don't do that. They were brainy hardware producers, not vinyl DJs, but they got to learn in public every Monday night at Quarter House after that, as Kier and Swung. Now they've spun at the Fruit, Bro Bar, Arcana, with Roundhouse at Motorco, and many other places. Roundhouse is their own collective, but they're still so open to everyone else, and we want to do the same thing, Damski says. We want to work together with everyone to not overbook weekends and to make sure everyone is successful, that there's healthy competition, but not aggressive competition. The first Fauna was an impromptu Moogfest 2019 after party at Manufacture, thereafter informally dubbed Maison Fauna. There have been three more since. One had a Wild West theme, another was a masquerade. Exclusivity can hold a certain snobbish appeal, but Fauna parties are $20 for an open bar with craft cocktails, thoughtful environmental and lighting design, and a long night of local heat. So it's accessible for what it is, and the benefits of exclusivity are safety and community. Deciduous will open a similar vibe to a broader audience. When we first moved here, there would be weekends where nothing was happening and weekends when everything was happening, and there would be 10 people at every event, Tamsky says. We should be throwing events that help foster a community where people show up because they know what to expect. Well, let's be clear. There are no shortages of good electronic dance parties in Durham on any given Friday night. Chances are decent that you'll find something to move with from Roundhouse or The Floor or Party Illegal or The Conjure or many others. If not, maybe No Visa or Shallow Cuts or Disco Sweat is popping off at Nightlight in Chapel Hill, or a cool underground techno producer is visiting The Wicked Witch or Ruby Deluxe in Raleigh. Maison Fauna's housekeepers aren't here to compete with existing efforts. They're here to bump your Friday night prospects from decent to definite and to build momentum for the whole local club culture in the process. Just to get more DJs from out of town coming here, this is, in a lot of ways, like virgin snow, Janito says. We want to bring the best, and they're going to enjoy it too, because playing in L.A. or New York is a nightmare for a lot of these people. On March 6th, a week before Deciduous debuts, Maison Fauna and Morning Choir are throwing a one-off party at the Fruit called Unrivaled Groove. It's a chance for Damsky to flaunt her love of UK garage alongside locals like Murad, Monsieur, and Tree City. UK garage, a descendant of house and an ancestor of dubstep, is an English sub-genre full of shuffling backbeats, staggering kick drums, and time and pitch shifted vocals. It formed the basis of Cure's Hardware mixtape, which was Maison Fauna's first online release in January. As a lover of UKG, I get really frustrated with the amount of music released that's not at my fingertips, Damsky says. She describes setting her alarm for 3:55 a.m. in the hopes of paying £35 to get a new single shipped overseas before it sells out. Maison Fauna's second release will be out June 20th, a date these rather druidic dance heads chose advisedly, as it's the solstice. It's an online compilation mixing locals with producers from L.A. and elsewhere that will also serve as an aesthetic mission statement. Dinito says the group is finalizing a distribution deal with Red Eye, though this wasn't confirmed at press time. Maison Fauna hopes to keep up a steady stream of monthly releases, singles, EPs, albums, live sets, after that. There are more places for locals to play electronic music than to release it. You might do an online record with Roundhouse if you're hip-hop based, or a limited edition vinyl or tape release with hot releases, or Tone Log if you're in the noise-adjacent techno realm, but options are scarce. Maison Fauna is trying to calibrate giving locals more bandwidth with hooking them into national circuits. They view Deciduous as a pipeline for the label, and they have the setup to release high-quality audio of visiting DJs' sets. The things we've received from people locally have been so inspiring, Damsky says. It's really exciting to hear that Tree City has put together this wild dance track with metal claps that you've never heard in his hip-hop music. He actually has a pretty large following in Durham and outside of it, but he's in that tier where so many more people would be into him if they just knew. But if a label that, for now, is only doing online releases is low overhead, a weekly party shipping DJs from New York, L.A., and Chicago is not. The first Deciduous features Baltra, followed in subsequent weeks by Garrett David and Masha. Even if you're selling outs and have the technical chops to produce everything yourself at $10 a head in the Fruit's 250-capacity basement, the math is tricky. Speaking ex cathedra, the economics of the event don't make sense, Bell says. This is the big reason it hasn't been done. Initially, they won't be profitable, but we look at it as a marketing expense for building the series. We're willing to take on the risk and the work to do the thing we want to see. Our thing is, how do we maintain authenticity while not losing all of the money that we're putting into the events? in a way where it's well-produced and people like Sarah, who doesn't have a Facebook, can find out about it. I've never been a part of something that has four founders, Tinito adds. If you think back to mythology, the only weakness of the Hydra is that you had to make it attack itself. As long as we're not fighting, as long as we have the trust, I think it can be a love Hydra. All right, to an article in the Stage section by Sarah Edwards. Ilana Glazer feels the burn. Last year's stoner comedy Broad City came to an end after five pitch-perfect seasons, and fans said goodbye to Abby and Ilana, the confident, freewheeling, and, yeah, super horny stars of the show. This week, Ilana Glazer is back with Horny for the Poles, a nine-city comedy show that will make its second stop in Durham. Horny for the Poles is a two-parter. There's the show at DPAC on March the 6th, where you can expect a more traditional comedy set, and where Glazer will be joined by the actor John David Washington, whose grandparents are from North Carolina. This is the only stop on the tour where Glazer will be joined by a celebrity guest. But first, there's the more unorthodox March 5th event, and that would be tonight. It's at the Pinhook in Durham. They are sold out. Which will be hosted by Generator Collective, the voter empowerment nonprofit that Glazer co-founded after the 2016 election. Sure, the framing is undeniably millennial. Glazer says that her mission is to make voting hot and fun and cool. She encourages attendees to take a hot photo that you've been waiting to post and make it swipe to a candidate on your upcoming ballot. But beyond thirst traps, Glazer is serious about lowering the barrier of entry to political engagement and sending young people to the polls with an informed political toolbox, especially when it comes to legislative politics. Ahead of her Durham stop, the Indy spoke with Glazer about her post-Broad City career, the loneliness of our electoral system, and why she's voting for Bernie Sanders. Indy, I'm curious about Jenny Social. What was the movement when you two were like a dance party and voting? Those two things can go together? Glazer. My collaborators on Generator, which are my co-founder, Glennis Meeker, and founding board member, Doug Melville, we had a meeting in August to talk about where Generator had gone the past 3 years and where we wanted it to go, and I think I just threw it out there. We were talking about needing another part or what we were missing, something lighter and more participatory, which the Jenny Socials are. You know, when you try something and it works and you're like, oh my God. We were shocked at how powerful it was to pair the right to vote with the joy of dancing. It's so easy to get informed and share with people when people are given a cheat sheet and trust someone with voting information. It's pretty easy. It's the loneliness that I think we feel and the bullying individuals feel from the system that makes it feel elusive and inaccessible. Indy, the North Carolina primary is March 3rd, and you're coming after that, so I'm curious. Is the primary a focus at all? Answer. We are more interested in amplifying the message and signal-boosting the legislators. What's been hard with programming our Jenny Socials is that we don't know who's going to be on the ballot yet, but by March 3rd, we're going to know, and what we hope to do is point people to those candidates' Instagrams. A big part of Jenny Social is to online canvass to their Instagram followers. We want people to know that it can be hot and cool to be civically engaged. We're going to be letting people know about the upcoming elections in their state and the presidential election, of course. But with what we have available to us at Jenny Social, with my platform as a comedian, we feel like we have a wider reach with state senators and congresspeople. Are you endorsing a presidential candidate on this tour? We're talking about endorsing two candidates because me and my co-founder are torn. I'm voting for Bernie in the primary. Elizabeth Warren is my hero. I wish there was ranked choice voting. I have not been a Bernie head for a long time, but I feel his messaging and delivery is most strategic for this primary. But that's not really what our focus is going to be. It's more about state legislatures. This binary system in general, two parties, one candidate, it's like this game. Politics aren't a game. I think there's a consciousness changing, at least with millennials and Gen Z. This binary thinking is not cool, not effective, not realistic. What has horny for the polls allowed you to access? You didn't tap into as much with Broad City. Well, with Broad City, I was really consumed with the show. It took Abby and I about 10 or 11 months to make the show. I hadn't been able to get out on the road and dedicate my time to stand-up. I did a tour and a special. It's called The Planet Is Burning on Amazon Video. And the power of stand-up has really washed over me. There's so much power in going on the road and talking face to face to face. I love laughing and being silly and free together. But I also have a generator, and I want to apply that freedom with the right to vote. And now, Emily Cataneo, column on art, jump-starting art. In 1980, Raleigh artists Margaret Richter, Bob Rankin, Barbara Burnham, and Marriott Little noticed a problem. There were no local resources for nascent creators to get their feet in the door of the art world. So they started a small group to help aspiring painters and sculptors begin their careers. 4 decades later, the Ad Idea has grown into a venerable cultural arts nonprofit on West Martin Street. VAE Raleigh celebrates its 40th birthday with a fundraising gala at Dorton Arena on March the 7th, coming right up. Has been many things to many people. An exhibition space for first-time artists, a place to learn professional skills, and a powerful ally of socially engaged art. It's been the force behind SparkCon, Raleigh's annual Pan Arts Festival, the host of a queer homecoming and many other kinds of gatherings, and an exhibitor of everything from poetry to painting, neon signs, to giant spray foam ducks. Indy sat down with Executive Director Brandon Cordery to discuss the phases of VAE's history, its efforts to combat the entrenched discrimination of the art world, and more. Indy, what were those original artists trying to achieve? How have you fulfilled that mission? Cordery, in 1980, there were 4 private galleries and great museums in Raleigh, but no other space for artists to get their start. Artsplosure, the cultural events production studio, was also founded in 1980. But NC State's Art United didn't exist, and neither did the United Arts Council, the funding wing of the county. Even the culture of hanging art in coffee shops wasn't as prominent as it is now, so those artists created an accessible space, flexible enough for new artists to fail and get better until they got the experience needed to rise to the gallery level. For a significant period, VAE was about accessibility for new artists. Then, they hired Sarah Powers as director and began to focus on professional skills. Then came Google, and all that information became accessible on the Internet. So around 2015, we began to do more work around socially engaged art. We looked around, and the art community had expanded so much around us. That allowed us the opportunity to curate ourselves, to focus on one particular part of art rather than trying to be everything to everyone. We began to focus on socially engaged art, which we see as contributing to positive change in the community. That's where we are now. Indy, how have issues around equity in the arts evolved since 1980, and how has VAE fought for equity in the arts? The cultural arts have a strong foundation in racial oppression and segregation. The arts community has begun to look that in its face and figure out ways to rectify it, but we don't see a lot of diversity at the very highest levels of arts organizations. We're still trying to achieve that real equity. 5 years ago, our board was 86% white. Now it's 44% white, which is much more reflective of the artists we're working with and the community we serve. We've also tried to change our physical space. We try to write text on the wall that's readable and solicits feedback. We believe that your interaction with this work and with us is the only way that the work is fully itself. We often play music so it's not a quiet white box, and paint the gallery so it's not actually a white box. And we have gallery guides who will ask questions. Like for our current exhibit, The Full Light of Day, which showcases the work of artists with disabilities, we ask, how many people with disabilities do you know? If you've used words like retarded or wheelchair-bound, how do you think the artists in this exhibition would feel about that? How do you feel about that? There's no wrong answer. Our space is also fully physically accessible. If someone who's blind or low vision comes into a quiet gallery, why would they want to do that? We recently had an audio-described and tactile tour where we had the Wake Federation for the Blind come through, feel things, and have conversations about the art. Indeed. One noticeable aspect of VAAE is how interdisciplinary you all seem to be. If creating social change is your end goal, then you're much less likely to focus on your own particular medium, and you're more likely to focus on what will ultimately get you to your goal. With our current project, there's a lot of visual art in the space, but there's also redacted literary work, and there's an artist who came in to do a performance piece that expanded on their visual art piece, which is all found objects. Indy, what's the history of your involvement with VAE? I had been hounding them, and they finally broke down and contracted me to help with street painting at SparkCon 2013. I came to help and stayed for the whole weekend and didn't leave, so I could make them like me. I convinced Sarah to hire me as exhibitions manager, then became director of exhibitions and helped with grants. When Sarah took a job with the city of Raleigh, I sent a note and said, "Hi, I would like your job." What's an exhibit in the past few years that stuck with you? I think our very first black-on-black exhibition with Mike Williams and Linda Dallas was a transition point for us. After Eric Garner's death in 2014, we knew the arts should be a part of the conversation about what was happening. We were not diverse enough as a staff to have that conversation come from us, and we wanted to support two curators of color curating work by artists of color that depict people of color. Indy, tell me about the gala. It's at Dorton Arena. There will be circus performers. There will be the Poetry Fox. There will probably be 200 works of art that have been donated by local artists. There will be auctions. We're doing a commission back to artists who donate, so we expect that this will put about $20,000 of funding into their pockets. Creative attire is encouraged. You'll see amazing outfits that range from comfy and casual to all-out wacky. It'll be our biggest celebration of the arts and our biggest celebration of turning 40. Lastly, what's on the horizon? We're going to need to move eventually, and with the city growing so fast, what does that mean? What's the smartest investment for us in terms of physical space, which is our biggest resource and biggest expense? We're also in a strategic planning process. What we're doing artistically and programmatically is going really well, but now we need to build structures around it. We'll continue supporting socially engaged art and operating in an open source way, but I think the quality of our work will continue to get even better as we build those structures and put them in place. Music. Meredith Monk and Vocal Ensemble's Cellular Songs appears tonight at UNC's Memorial Hall in Chapel Hill. Tickets $27, and it's at 7:30 p.m. And there is an article about that, and I'm reading that now in hopes that maybe some of you can get there. I've heard them. Justin Torno writes, Meredith Monk is world-renowned for her interdisciplinary explorations of the voice as an expressive, mostly nonverbal instrument. Her six-decade body of work integrates music, movement, and visuals in deeply poignant performances. Cellular Songs, her celebrated concert with her vocal ensemble, explores the activity of the fundamental element, the cell, to present an alternative template for human action and interaction. In a way, the piece grew out of On Behalf of Nature, which Monk spent some time developing at Duke University. Before Monk brings the concert to Carolina Performing Arts on March 5, that's tonight, we spoke with her about the piece's genesis and process and how they connect to the foundation of human values that permeate her work. Indy. On Behalf of Nature is sort of a precursor to Cellular Songs, right? I've heard you draw parallels between cells in music, the human body, and the universe, and it seems like these correlations would provide lots of layers and textures. Oh, yes, of course. Many of my pieces are inspired by nature, but Cellular Songs is very concerned with the ecological situation of the Earth. Even the way we made the piece, we were thinking from an ecological point of view. For example, if you have all these costumes and they sit in storage somewhere, how could you make a piece that doesn't leave a footprint? Basically, we recycled our own personal clothing, and then Yoshio Yabara, our costume designer, patched together all these pieces to create the costumes. We even did an exhibit in the lobby where he did drawings of each of our costumes, and we wrote each about what the pieces of clothing had been. This was all very close to the Claude Lévi-Strauss concept of bricolage, about taking something ordinary and repurposing it. I knew that because my work is largely nonverbal. I wasn't going to be able to make a piece that says, "Please don't use plastic," or be specific or overtly political. In a way, On Behalf of Nature was a kind of elegy, suggesting what is at stake if we don't adjust. I thought it could be helpful to make people look at things or listen to things differently when they were in nature. In On Behalf of Nature, I wanted to use music and gesture to suggest the rhythms, the energies, the motors of nature, not reproducing or illustrating, but evoking. Cellular songs, extends that concept deeper into the organism, breaking reality down into the fundamental unit of life, the cell. When I started working on the piece around 2014, just working at the keyboard, I didn't know it was the piece yet. I was laying these very intricately woven vocal layers. I picked up a book called The Emperor of All Maladies by Siddhartha Mukherjee. The book is basically on the history of cancer, going all the way back to ancient times. What struck me was his description of the intelligence of a cell and how the processes are so complex and interdependent. It's a very cooperative situation. When you multiply that by billions to make up these miracles, our instruments, our bodies, the cells have got to cooperate. So I started thinking, isn't this an incredible metaphor for what's going on in our society? I think I was already sensing what was coming up in the political realm, the patriarchal energy, a feeling of compression rather than expansion, limitation rather than openness, greed instead of generosity. I felt like it could be really interesting to make an abstract poetic piece in response to these energies. Indy, without having to be explicit about it. Yes, exactly. It's all in there, though. In Cellular Songs, we're offering an alternative that's generous and kind and codependent instead of cruel. We were asking, what does that look like? Showing kindness instead of cruelty, generosity instead of greed, collaboration rather than competition. I was determined to have those values be all a part of the process itself. In a weird way, just the way we behave with each other becomes the subtext of the music and the gesture. How do we make our process itself feel energetically generative for the people who are making it? Asks the indie. That's become more important to me, the more desperate the things feel in the world about us. Exactly. I think this piece is a template for the possibility of human behavior, but also what you're talking about in terms of the process. You can't put your finger on it. It's not delineated, but you can feel it. It becomes part of the energetic atmosphere of the performance. And you'd never get to those states if you hadn't been your process. You know what I mean? Yes, I'm nodding vigorously. Another thing that started with On Behalf of Nature and really came into focus on Cellular is that because my music has become so complex, I have to figure out a way to simplify the movement and gestural aspects, and it scared me, feeling like, oh my God, would this be too simple? Because we live in a very visual culture, and as soon as you put movement to music, the music becomes accompaniment. So my question was, how do I make it so that the music is actually the continuity and the core? And then any other elements become so transparent that you can still perceive the complexity of the music. The audience in Chapel Hill should know that the foreground of our Cellular Songs concert version is the singing. Don't expect that the movement will be the foreground, but as you'll see, it's very embodied. And there's humor. Why can't a piece include tragedy and comedy and everything all in one? Some of the most brilliant pieces I've seen like this are films. Roberto Rossellini's The Open City is about horrifying times in World War II during the occupation, but there's such a funny scene in that film. And I think you have to have that kind of release when you're doing something that deep. It's like you get so full with all the tragedy, it's nice to have the opportunity to drain a little bit so you have some room to feel deeply again. She answers yes, and speaking of these layers, right now I'm making the album of Cellular Songs, and I am rewriting a little bit. I'm bringing other instruments in, so you can get as full of an experience orally as you would get seeing it live, you know, since we can't dance on an album. Indy, an essay you wrote had a huge impact on me, specifically this kind of language you used around process. You used the word multi-perceptual. Yeah, I like it better than interdisciplinary. Artists should attend to a variety of ways a work can be perceived. I say this to my students at Harvard, especially electronic composers. How do you want this to be seen? Take into account that we also have eyes. And with dance students, it's good to talk about how you want the dance to be heard and the possibilities of perception in terms of the vantage point of the audience. Does this relate to your idea of cells taking on so many forms in Cellular Songs? Definitely. The main thing is that reality is always changing, microscopically or in the universe. So that sense of fluidity is something that I was really going for. In the process writing, the decentering of the ego is always in there. My mentor used to say, the work is going to tell you where to go. Absolutely. That's it. And the other part of it is the beginner's mind. Go into each process with no expectations. And that allows you to listen to the work when it's telling you what it wants. Well, the Deep Sea Duo has snorkeled back down again to help close this edition of Indie Week. After the initial airing, it can be found on our website, ncreadingservice.org, under the podcast section. It was made for our blind and print-impaired listeners and read by me, John Federson. I see our skipper is beginning to come to the surface now, and I hope you all will be there again to listen to the next issue of Indie Week. So long.